This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with one of the last of the World War II Army nurses, 100-year-old Jane Boot of Fresno, California. Originally from Erie, Pennsylvania, she grew up near Wesleyville as Jane Kissinger, the youngest of five children. Jane was one of 59,000 women to serve in the Army Nurse Corps during World War II. Her first deployment was to Iceland, of all places, but when we left off, she was at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C. In April of 1942, Jimmy Doolittle had led the daring raid on Tokyo, flying the first of 16 B-25 bombers off the deck of the USS Hornet. It was something no one had tried or ever dreamed of before, and with five men aboard each B-25, there were 80 men total, embarking on what they knew would be a one-way mission. 77 of them would survive. Three men were executed after being captured by the Japanese army in China. Another crew landed in the Soviet Union and was held captive for a year before finally being released. And some of those who made it fairly quickly back to the United States were in need of medical attention, which is why they ended up in the officers' ward at Walter Reed. So, Jane, you actually helped nurse a couple of those Doolittle Raiders back to health, right?
Yes, Ted Lawson had, of course, Dr. White was with that raid, and he amputated Ted Lawson's leg because it was infected in China. So that he and I think another guy, Thompson, I think his name was, had dislocated shoulders, apparently had gotten, when he landed in the straps from the parachute, dislocated his shoulders, I think. So I think they were the only two patients we got from that.
I don't want to keep digging too hard, and if you're done talking about it, let me know. But I'm interested in this because, you know, now all of the Doolittle Raiders are gone. The last one died about a year ago, Dick Cole.
Yes.
But in that moment, you're seeing physically what had happened to them, but the reality was it could have been a lot worse for them. That they knew they couldn't go back to the carrier. This was a one-way mission. They didn't know what was going to happen if they landed somewhere, if they didn't get shot down in those B-25s. Did knowing what they had done, the courage that it required, did that have an effect on you as you're caring for them?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We really honored, and these guys were great.
So you were talking about Ted Lawson. Do you know where he's from? Do you know where he grew up?
Yes, in California.
Right here in Fresno.
Fresno?
Yep.
I remember when his wife died, I was living in San Jose.
Now, as you're caring for these guys, do you talk to them at all about what they'd been through, or did you hear any stories about what it was like to crash land in China and try to get back?
Not really. They did not talk a lot about it. Just that, you know, it was a distressing time for them.
How severe were the injuries they were dealing with?
Yeah, I think we just had those two patients. Of course, we saw the other guys occasionally. They'd come to visit. And one of them had mental troubles, and they couldn't find him for a while. Doolittle spent a lot of time finding that guy because he, you know, didn't know who he was. I guess he finally located him. I remember he was so distressed because he wasn't in uniform. Of course, by that time, he'd probably been through sets of clothes getting where he was. And he ordered new uniforms for him, and even his back pay, he insisted they come and give him his back pay. So I thought that was being very considerate.
Well, the other thing that comes to mind is, I mean, we know that, as you just said, that was more of a symbolic victory. It didn't devastate the enemy militarily, but it proved America can hit Japan. And there was a price that was paid for that hit on Japan, and you were looking at it. I mean, you saw this guy's life was never going to be the same. Is that and I have friends that are nurses, that they see traumatic things, I know. As a young woman, to look at someone who just gave up a piece of himself for everybody else in the country, what kind of effect does that have on you?
Oh, well, I don't know. Of course, I really honored these guys. Mm-hmm. I said it was, you know, I thought I was privileged to take care of them, which proved to be true.
What was your rank at the time?
I was a first lieutenant by then.
Well, the reason I ask is because I understand. You mentioned that some of the other Doolittle Raiders would come visit these guys while they were under your care. And I understand that that you tried to kick a private off of the officer's ward before you found out who he really was?
He came on the ward dressed like a buck private. And I had just been assigned to the officer's ward, and I was kind of full of it. And so he was talking to another guy. Anyway, I walked up to them, and I was going to say to him, you know, why are you in this officer's ward? You know, what's your business here? And along came this guy who was a spit and polish, all dressed up in uniform and insignia and everything, calling out to, oh, and then I didn't realize who he was at first. I should have recognized him, but I didn't. I didn't expect to see him, I guess. And anyway, this guy calls out to him, oh, you know, General Doolittle, no, 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 no. At the end of it, I'll be in Alaska. But he was very nice, put his arm around my shoulder. I was just doing my duty. Very gracious guy. Of course, I got to know him quite well then. He came often to see his boys, as he called them.
Well, I guess that gives you a taste into what he must have been dealing with, too, his celebrity during this time.
Yes.
I mean, because when he gets back from that, he's given the Medal of Honor.
Right.
His picture's on the front page of every newspaper. He'd already been famous before the war as an aviator.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he felt he had to be incognito to see those guys, apparently.
Probably.
That's a pretty good claim to fame, Jane. I kicked General Doolittle out of the officer's ward, or at least tried to.
Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned that you got to know him quite well. You know, he's someone that a lot has been written about and said about. You saw him in a time where I'm sure his heart was shining through.
Yeah.
What were some of the things that you observed about Jimmy Doolittle?
He was a very humble person, really. He didn't flaunt his status or his claim to fame or anything. Seemed to be very concerned about other people, and especially his boys, and came often at night when he would be out for something else, he'd stop, see them. So I admired him a lot.
Well, I bet you also got a view of what that meant to them to have him there checking on them.
Yes. I think his men all knew that he was their prime concern.
And speaking of Ted Lawson, the plane that he flew that day was called the Ruptured Duck. They have a representation of that in Hawaii. If you go to the Pacific Aviation Museum, they have the Ruptured Duck there. But he then was the person, if I'm remembering right, wrote the book,
right,
30 Seconds Over Tokyo.
Yes.
Which then became a movie. Were you still in the States when that was coming out, or were you already overseas?
Yeah, no, I was, I can't remember where I was, but I remember about that had come out while I was there. Yeah, I was still here.
So that must have been a little surreal to go to the movies and...
And what, yes.
You had a connection to this guy.
Yeah, they did a very good job. It was actually, of course, I think Ted insisted on being kind of a director in that. He didn't want a lot of false stuff. And they did pretty well until they got to the end, and they just couldn't show a toothless Van Johnson who was playing his part. They just couldn't bring themselves to do that. But Ted, he lost all his teeth when he went through that windshield. That was the only part that really wasn't true.
Now that I hear you mentioning that, I guess I should have had you describe for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, since here's a patient you're caring for and you're informed of everything that had happened to him. Can you describe for us, as you understand it, what happened to him at the end of that mission, that one-way mission to Tokyo?
He tried to make the coast, but didn't have enough gas. So that's why he landed on the, like on the beach, but beaches aren't very good landing strips. And when he hit the beach land, sand stopped the ship and it threw him through the windshield, and that's when he lost his teeth.
So you're caring for a guy who's lost all of his teeth and lost one of his legs.
Yep.
What were his spirits like?
Actually, he was in pretty good spirits. His wife came to see him. He didn't want her to come, but Jimmy Doolittle insisted that they bring the wives in. And he got so excited when he saw her, he jumped out of bed and fell flat on his face because he forgot he didn't have a leg.
Wow.
So, but that was true, and I reported that because I saw it.
You saw it happen. All right. So you care for him. He writes the book. It becomes a movie. You see Van Johnson, this big movie star, playing the guy that you've gotten to know. And then the Americans are going to make a landing in Europe. So there's going to be a need for nurses to go overseas. Is that something you had considered, that you might get sent overseas at some point?
Sure. There was always a chance. And it seemed like if you were gone once, they thought, hey, well, they already know what it's all about. We'll send them again.
So because you'd been to Iceland, they knew you could handle going across to Europe.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
It was a much better crossing. They used the Southern Crossing. It was warmer. And it was a bigger ship.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a much smoother crossing going over to Europe. We landed in Cherbourg.
Uh-huh. How many nurses were with you this time?
This time I think we had almost a full hospital group, which would probably be around 10.
So where did they send you once you landed in France?
We went into Germany to Mainz. I think there were two little towns called Mainz and Worms. Anyway, Mainz and Worms stays in my mind. And that's as far as we got into Germany. And then things were over and we came back.
Uh-huh.
So that was as far as we got into Germany, which was about halfway, I guess, and to the west.
But you'd been in France, maybe Belgium, Luxembourg.
Belgium and Luxembourg.
And then
Germany. Go through those to get to Germany.
Right. And so you're basically following Patton's Third Army as they're capturing territory. The Battle of the Bulge happens. There's a ton of casualties from that.
Right.
And you were caring for some of them?
Yes. Well, Patton was going. He was just trying to go so fast. We couldn't keep up with him. So we finally settled down.
And there were different kinds of hospitals, different degrees or different distances from the front. What kind of hospital
right.
were you working at?
This was what we call an evac hospital. I don't know what they called them in Korea.
Oh, the MASH units?
MASH units, yeah.
Uh-huh.
We called them evac units, and that's exactly what they did. We triaged them and evacuated them either to a general hospital or flew them back to the base. So that's what we did most of the time. So we didn't keep a lot of people there all the time.
Was that a challenging task?
Yes, yes. Because you really... It made a difference whether they got to the right care when they needed it. So it behooved you to really be alert to everything that counted.
And can you give us an idea of the kind of shape these guys were in, the kind of injuries that you were seeing or dealing with or try to save them from?
There seemed to be a number of chest injuries and otherwise arms and legs seemed to get injured, I suppose, because they were trying to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw a lot of that. Broken limbs.
And if one of your grandchildren were here right here and said, Grandma, tell us, what was your job at that point? What did you have to do? What was the point of it? How would you describe that, what you were tasked with doing at that point? Was it bringing comfort? Was it just deciding where they were going to go, in which
right.
direction? Can you help us understand what that would have been like? What were the different things you had to be responsible for?
Well, you had to know what injury needed to be seen immediately and what could wait. So this was pretty much, of course, anything bleeding got immediate attention. Otherwise, broken bones, of course, could wait for a while. So it was just you. It was something you just had to, and you got better at it as you did it, getting them to the right place at the right time.
Did it ever feel overwhelming?
Yes. Yeah. And yet other times it was very slow, depending on, of course, what was going on.
But there were some periods where the influx was so great that it was hard to keep up?
Right.
Would you have to work around the clock, or how would they handle that?
Yes, we sometimes worked. Yeah, there were some periods that were very slow, and we, you know, had a really normal time. But others that were so rapid, we worked many hours on, almost till you dropped, actually got to the point where you might make a wrong decision, and then, of course, you knocked off and slept for a while. But we worked sometimes many hours on straight.
So you're so exhausted, you might not even be thinking straight anymore.
Right, and it was time to take a rest.
And right now, it's time for us to take our last break. But there's much more to come with 100-year-old Jane Boot. What else does she remember about those courageous soldiers she cared for in Europe in World War II? Find photos and a short video of Jane online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you'll also find a link to the Veterans Home of California in Fresno, where she now makes her home. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.